Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Amy and I are happy to share with you that I'm running to serve you as the next president of the United States of America. This is a defining moment of truth for this country and for every single one of us. The challenges that we face right now, the interconnected crises in our economy, our democracy, and our climate have never been greater, and they will either consume us or they will afford us the greatest opportunity to unleash the genius of the United States of America. In other words, this moment of peril produces perhaps the greatest moment of promise for this country and for everyone inside of it.
Oh, we're back. Oh, yeah, we're here. Beto O'Rourke got into the race. Oh, my goodness. I'm surprised that the media fawning all over him, that they didn't actually just film the whole thing in a big hot tub with everybody sitting around the hot tubs talking about how we're all going to melt away from climate change and there'll be the great patterns of migration that will destroy huge swaths of land and it's all going to be over unless Beto comes in and taxes you to death. I mean, let's do the whole thing in a hot tub, okay? Why even pretend that this is going to be some type of discerning coverage of Beto O'Rourke? Well, I told you this was going to happen. I said that the Democrats see their path to victory in 2020 running through Texas. And whether he's on the top of the ticket or ultimately chosen as a possible vice presidential pick, that's what they think will bolster turnout in 2020. And if they win Texas, they win it. So I think it's a cynical, but in many ways a strategic choice for the Democrats to build someone like a Beto O'Rourke up. We all know he was in Congress for a couple terms, was an El Paso City official. He had a very interesting moment on Instagram where he filmed his dental surgery recently. That was fun. And he claims to be someone who's very optimistic and he doesn't want to get negative. He's very optimistic. I thought his whole thing was so depressing. I mean, this is one of the greatest times ever to be an American citizen. Economic opportunities galore. Wages are up 3%. As, by the way, wages stagnating in the rest of the G7. In Europe, wages are stagnating. Britain, wages are stagnating. This is a great time, finally, to be just a regular working person. If you want to work, there is no reason why you can't get a job and why you can't have upward mobility in that job. But you never know it listening to Beto O'Rourke. And gosh, after 8 years of Obama and Biden, I can't imagine all these issues weren't solved.
At this moment of maximum peril and maximum potential, let's show ourselves and those who will succeed us in this great country just who we are and what we can do.
Well, there was an author of the piece in Vanity Fair, which I'm going to do some dramatic readings from. Joe Hagan was on Morning Joe this morning. And again, this piece was an embarrassment. It was just the most fawning, sycophantic, truculent description of him and his bookshelf and his sports. And oh, no. It was Obama-esque, because that's the kind of pieces they did about Obama, with his glistening pecs. When he emerged from the surf, his glistening pecs bespoke a man who knew who he was and where he was going. It was hilarious. But there's some simple questions for this author of this setup. It's called a setup piece. This was all timed. The Vanity Fair piece comes out and then his announcement. Okay, it's all perfectly timed. So you would imagine that the guy who spent all this time with Beto O'Rourke would have some idea what Beto O'Rourke's vision is.
Some of the scrutiny and criticism, perhaps, of O'Rourke has been that he doesn't seem, people are not sure what he stands for.
Right.
Like, you know, that he's, the idea is he's just this blank canvas. Is he aware of that criticism?
Absolutely. First of all, you got to know, you know, he's a canny guy. You know, he knows what he's doing. And when he was a congressman, his
thing was that he would work with Republicans. So we'll see if he can in terms of his policy prescriptions, come up with a balance that kind of makes everybody happy. But, you know, he's going to have to define himself on the fly, really.
He's going to have to define himself on the fly. So, in other words, he's just a tabula rasa. He's just a big Rorschach test. Whatever you want him to be, Beto will be. And beyond just this Morning Joe conversation, this author was parading all over cable television and just talking about the Beto experience.
I got to see him kind of like with his hair down, really. It was a Sunday afternoon, and there he was, just regular guy doing his thing with the kids. And I have to say that there's a kind of unvarnished, sort of real, down-to-earth, charismatic character there. You know, but he is sort of undefined right now. He's like a charisma candidate.
Well, at least he's admitting it. At least Joe Hagan is admitting the guy stands for nothing except a lot of cliches about saving the planet and the peril that we're in because of climate change. And we're all going to come together and diversity is our greatest strength. And the moment that we're in now is filled with peril and promise. It's just the same old liberal bleh. Again, when it comes down to policies, what does this all mean? It means hold your wallet, watch your children. They're coming for your money. They're coming for your freedom. They want to make decisions for you. That's what this is all about. And so, yeah, he might be in his shirt and his jeans and rolling around the floor with his kids and know his dog on a dirt road. It's just, this is Beto. But it just means more taxes. It just means higher taxes, lower standard of living for the average American. Because you can't have cars, and you can't fly around on planes, and you can't do fracking, right? Not really. If you're getting rid of the fossil fuel industry, the second generation fracking that's going on right now, which is going to make America 100%, really could be 100% energy independent. This has revolutionized the Texas economy, fracking. I've seen it up close in travels to Midland, being out there with drillers. This is incredible technology. And America will no longer be dependent on these bad actors, these foreign actors, in countries where we've wasted money, blood, treasure, sweat, tears, America's wealth. We're not going to need it anymore. But when you really unpack beyond the cliches, what his worldview would lead to, it would lead to the dismantlement of all of that. So unless you're maybe a computer programmer working for a new green energy technology subsidized by the U.S. taxpayers, then I don't really know what you're going to do. What are you going to do in the Beto economy? Because most people just like need regular jobs. Most people don't live in this rarefied world of, well, we're all going to be doing computer coding, and I'm going to be inventing the next app that gets you a parking space faster for your electric car, whatever that is. But I'm telling you, keep an eye on him. We can kind of dismiss him and laugh at him and all we want, but he is going to be, in my view, well, he has the potential to be a real force. And if you force me to predict something right now, if I'd be forced to predict it, I would say he would be the vice presidential pick for any candidate. And it's all about winning Texas. If you just want to win, you got to go with Texas. You got to go with a guy who can turn the vote out. And especially if Castro is successful, well, if he really is able to get the Hispanic vote out big time against Cornyn, then that's also going to be trouble for the Republicans. And then the whole game is off. You're listening to your Healthy Radio Addiction. I want to thank our sponsor, GenuCell, because they help provide this podcast to you free every week. And you're going to learn more about all their great and special offers coming up in the show. Well, Kyle Swenson in the Washington Post reminded us of what the Beto photo on the cover of Vanity Fair reminds everyone of. And I had not thought about this until I read this paragraph. But completely on point. Eagle-eyed sleuths on the internet were more curious about the cover portrait. Again, it's Beto with his hands on his hips, kind of in his back pocket of his jeans, in a blue button-down, tousled hair, dirt road, pickup truck, black lab. Okay. As some pointed out, the image bears an uncanny resemblance to a 2007 magazine cover of John Edwards, another presidential hopeful, then featured on the now-shuttered Men's Vogue. Sly grin, outdoors, jeans, truck, family dog. Both magazines are owned by Condé Nast. Both pieces were penned by Joe Hagan, and both photos were taken by Annie Leibovitz, the lefty photographer to the political stars and Hollywood. But this is establishing a brand. Just so you understand, the brand is handsome, Kennedy-esque, cool factor. Texas doesn't have to be white male conservative. Texas could be white male into diversity. And this is all carefully focus grouped and tested. Don't believe for a second that this is all about, oh, well, he's going to look at polls. He's not going to look at a poll. He's not a poll guy. He's, as Joe Hagan said, he's just kind of down to earth. Oh, please. And then it was Beto on immigration.
We can begin by fixing our democracy and ensuring that our government works for everyone and not just for corporations. And all of us, wherever you live, can acknowledge that if immigration is a problem, it's the best possible problem for this country to have. And we should ensure that there are lawful paths to work, to be with family, and to flee persecution.
So it's a good problem to have. Huh. It's a good problem to have unless you happen to be the woman who was killed, Bambi Larson, by an illegal immigrant, David Gonzalez, who was detained by ICE, who was jailed in California on multiple occasions, who, I think, to put it accurately, ICE tried to get him deported several times, but both in Santa Clara and L.A. counties, sanctuary cities, obviously, the whole state's a sanctuary. But This is all about protecting American citizens, innocent Americans. But for Beto, it's a great problem to have. Great problem to have. Really. Not a great problem for that 12-year-old little girl who was raped in Alabama. Not a problem for her? Gosh, I thought it would pretty much ruin her life. Is it a problem for the police officers gunned down by illegal immigrants? Is it a problem for those whose children been poisoned by fentanyl brought in by illegal immigrants? Is that a problem, Beto, or no? It's all good. So the pretty boy of today could be the political roadkill of tomorrow. And remember, for all of you think, oh, well, it sounds reasonable. Beto's just for making it all work better. Remember what he said a few weeks back.
I want to pass along from a question from a congressman who does not represent the border, but he is in Texas, Dan Crenshaw, who's a new member of Congress. And he wanted to ask you, he tweeted this, I'm just passing it along. You know, would you, if you could, would you take the wall down now? Here.
Yes.
Like you have a wall.
Absolutely.
Knock it down.
I'd take the wall down.
And do you think the city, you think if there's a referendum here in this city, that would pass?
I do.
So that's how radical he is. He's trying to pass himself off as a more sensible Democrat as compared to the newbie congresswomen radical types, saying, I'm a capitalist. Well, he was a small business owner, big deal. His family, you know, business owners in Texas did pretty well. But the idea that somehow a guy who did not beat Ted Cruz says to a journalist who Joe Hagan's an old political operative, but says to journalists, I was born for this. I was born for this, man. Born to do this. It really does never cease to amaze me how both needy and they're arrogant, they're conceited, they're narcissistic, and terribly insecure. I guess that applies to a lot of us, but especially people who think like Obama really thought. I think because friends of mine in Harvard Law School said he talked about running for president, you know, when he was in school. People who are in college and think, this is my destiny. There's something very, they're very needy. And for him to have this sense about himself that without really significant wins, political wins recently, that he's born to do this, on what basis? What has he really accomplished? Oh, he won a congressional seat? Big deal. I think he's about a millimeter deep. That's my prediction. I don't want to say, you know, progressive pinup, but okay. Hashtag progressive pinup. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham podcast. If you want to be part of the show, make sure to email us at ingram.podcast@gmail.com. That's ingram.podcast@gmail.com. MSNBC had a very objective commentator on this morning from MoveOn.org, another Soros front group, named Corinne Jean-Pierre. Let's listen.
Beto O'Rourke, one of the reasons he made it into the national scene back in the midterm election is because of those viral moments. I heard someone talk about the NFL, the kneeling moment that went viral. Beto O'Rourke is really good at that, finding. He has truly does have raw talent, and he finds those moments and is able to really take it to the next level. And so that was the thing that was very impressive about him during the midterm election. As someone myself, I worked on both Obama campaigns. Yeah, he has that raw talent. He is very kind of Obama-esque indeed.
Obama-esque. Well, as far as we can discern from the reporting, the Obamas are pushing him. They see him as the logical continuation of the Obama administration. That the Obama mystique, I should say. So he's not black, but he embodies the desire for, you know, and he talked about representing the oppressed. We'll play that soundbite. Clearly hinting at reparations for past behavior. I mean, he sees himself as the man who can right all past racial wrongs. Again, when he talks about leveling the playing field for the oppressed, he's talking about taking money from you and giving it to other people. So I'm just going to decode all this. Dave in New Jersey. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, Laura, I mean, really, what has this guy accomplished? He's accomplished zero. He spent three terms in the U.S. Senate or in the U.S. House of Representatives. What has he accomplished for his constituents? He lost his Senate race to Ted Cruz.
Not by much. He only lost by 2.5 percentage points, and that's only because Trump came in and took it to the mat. So yeah. Ted Cruz is not exactly Mr. Popularity in Texas. I got to tell you that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got the left blowing his head up for what? To think he can be president on what? Good looks and fast talk?
Yes, they do, because they know we're living in the social media age where young people get their news in 3 or 4 lines on Instagram or Facebook. Twitter, not really, but Instagram, Facebook. And if it's a 30-second video and he looks kind of cute and he's kind of handsome and he seems like he cares, there are a lot of people who are like, okay, I'll go with him. The other guy, because they tell me that the other guy, Trump, is just mean. And if I vote for him, I'm a bad person. I mean, look at how these social media influencers get these young girls to buy makeup lines and certain types of shoes and shirts. I mean, it's all a version of the same thing. It's just mass marketing to the vulnerable and, to some extent, the ignorant, the politically ignorant, or the politically brainwashed or propagandized as they are in college and high school and so forth, and sometimes by their parents. So a lot of people will vote for superficial reasons. Now, does that mean people are going to vote? If this economy is as hot as it is right now, does that mean people are going to vote against their economic interests? Well, we have a different demography to deal with right now in the United States of America. We give green cards every year to about 1.2 million people. So that's a lot of voters, 1.2 million. And those new immigrants, I think the last estimate was that by about a 2-to-1 margin, they're voting Democrat. 2-to-1 margin. What is that going to do to Texas? Already did it to California.
Question is on the Green New Deal. And by extension, if you don't mind, I'll take the spirit of the question. We face catastrophe and crisis on this planet. There will be people who can no longer live in the cities that they call home today. There's going to be massive migration of tens or hundreds of millions of people from countries that are literally uninhabitable or underwater that are above the sea right now. This is our final chance. The scientists are absolutely unanimous on this, that we have no more than 12 years to take incredibly bold action on this crisis.
So basically, he's a white male version of AOC. That's what he is. I mean, that's what he is. But what does bold action on this mean? No more cars, no more driving, government mandated miles driven and carbon taxes. What are we talking? Tell me, what are we talking about? But this wild is wild. You know what also just already bugs me right off the bat? This is like a Seinfeldian criticism. It's too much with the hands. It's too much with the big hand. He has the big hand gestures. Like he went to some media coach who said, okay, you have to gesticulate and make your point and really get your hands out there. So his hands are always wildly moving. But more than that, it's this alarmism that's masquerading as lucid thought on a complicated issue like climate, as climate's changed over the last 3 million years, and the planet's been warming for several hundred years already, as we talked about the other day with our great guest, Gregory Wrightsman. Am I getting that right?
Wrightstone.
Wrightstone. His book, The Inconvenient Facts. All right, joining us now, Mercedes Schlapp, White House Director of Strategic Comms, about a lot of things. We're going to talk to her about what's going on with these Republicans. And Mercedes, are you surprised about the big Beto rollout? Everything except the glistening pectoralis muscles and remember when they used to write about Obama coming out of the surf
right.
in Hawaii? Yeah.
The photos, I tell you, those are the ones in Vanity Fair. That's like the new way to launch a presidential campaign, it must be.
Yeah.
Launch it on Vanity Fair.
No, and the best is can you imagine they're ever doing a series of photos like about Devin Nunes or something like that. Like, Devin Nunes emerged from his truck in the Central Valley of California, the sun peeking over the horizon.
Although you got to admit the black lab in the back, so cute.
Yeah, well,
because I know you're a lab lover like I am.
See, even Mercedes is falling for it. Even Mercedes Schlapp is falling for the good-looking guy with a lab.
I've had to try to see if we can get President Trump to get a dog, and I've just been
He has no desire. I've talked to him about it. He has no desire to get a dog. I mean, the thing is, I like the fact. I think it's really funny. I've always loved curmudgeons. I think for some reason, they crack me up. And I like the fact that he says, let's make me look fake. I'm going to walk around with some dog on the White House lawn, some shaggy dog. It's like, I'm authentic. That's the opposite of Trump. I love the fact that he says he doesn't want a dog. I think it's hilarious. All right, Mercedes, we got to talk about these Republicans moving on to the emergency declaration. Everyone from Rand Paul to Mike Lee, Murkowski and the crowd saying no to this emergency declaration, saying the president's going beyond his constitutional prerogative here. And the president responded by saying that's going to be a bad decision. But is that all? Is that all the White House can do? I guess just say they're upset about it.
Well, the president made a good point yesterday in one of the meetings where he said, look, these Democrats, They stay united. They're united on open borders. They're united on illegal immigration. They are united on allowing for increased criminals to come into our borders, drugs to come into our borders, and human traffickers to benefit from our immigration system. And here we have the Republicans that they can't stay united on this issue. I mean, it is a no-brainer. They have to ask themselves the question, are these Republicans, including Mitt Romney, who also came out, basically, are they going to stand with Schumer and Pelosi, or are they going to stand with the president and the American people who want public safety, who want to improve our immigration system, and who want to support our Border Patrol agents who are overwhelmed in what they're seeing at the border right now?
No, and I think, again, we've seen presidents declare 57 emergencies, 31 are still in force, and now we have Republicans who decide they're going to get all high and mighty after they themselves delegated the authority to the president to declare national emergencies. They did it themselves back in the 1970s.
Yeah, they did. And so it's what's unfortunate is we know that the president is clearly justified in declaring this national emergency. He's using the statutory authorities that Congress gave him to address this crisis at our border. And what we know today, and you know this clearly because you've been at the border, it's not even a crisis anymore. It is an emergency. I mean, the mere fact of all the drugs that are being seized at the border and are basically the drug cartels and their growth and their networks that they have, that their drugs are ending up in our communities. It's what Chief of U.S. Customs Border Patrol Carla Provost said yesterday at one of our meetings, where she said, When I can't sleep at night is when I have to think about not the drugs that were seized, but the drugs that are coming in between the ports of entry that we are not detecting. And that is the problem that we're seeing. And then this is, of course, infiltrating into our communities. And we need to put a stop to this.
Well, again, we reported on this last night on the Ingram Angle, 12-year-old girl raped in Alabama by an illegal immigrant found hiding in a closet. And then another illegal immigrant who they tried to detain 9 times in ICE, but the detainers were not honored because sanctuary city policies in California. And another person tagged online, I guess it was Obama's way of dealing with the criminals and the criminal releases, not being able to deport them. That was also part of the problem with this most recent murder of Bambi Larson, who is a woman alone, 61 years of age, lived alone, and this illegal immigrant stalked her and murdered her, left her for dead.
And then you have New York, for example, where, you know, with the sanctuary city, where the law enforcement won't help our ICE officers by detaining these legal aliens. And so you have these illegal aliens with criminal records that are able to get out of the jails. And then our ICE agents have to go, officers need to go out and try to find them and detain them, putting our ICE officers in danger, their lives in danger. And the stories become that it then becomes an issue where the criminal ends up trying to attack our ICE agents, putting their lives at risk. It's just does not make sense. And it's why the president is so committed to this issue and why he has said, we got to use the funds to build the walls that we need, to build these physical barriers that we know work, in order to ensure that not only are we hardening at the ports of entry, but hardening between the ports of entry, that are the smugglers, the coyotes, the human traffickers, the drug cartels take advantage of every single day.
No, and meanwhile, Beto O'Rourke last night says, "Oh well, if we have to have a problem, immigration's a good problem to have." Basically saying we can benefit so much from immigration and make sure people can just come and work and whatever, as long as they just can come and work and escape. It all sounds good. Escape oppression. But we know people are gaming the system. They're just gaming the system. They have been, and Congress hasn't changed the law, hasn't closed the loopholes on asylum.
Right. I mean, I'll tell you, you know my family's history, and my father was a political prisoner in Cuba. He had to escape oppression because of communist rule by the Fidel Castro dictatorship. He came here legally. He loves America more than anyone else I know. He loves this president. And I have to tell you something. The way to come to this country is legally. There is a system in place that needs improvements, that needs reforms, but and it should be based on merit, and it should be based on what you can contribute to our economy, and not based on just randomness and chaos, which is what we see at the border every day. I was talking to a general at the Department of Defense who explained to me, she said, the Border Patrol agents spend more time processing illegal aliens at the border than they have time to monitor and use the equipment that Department of Defense has provided. So they have these radar platforms to monitor and see what they can do to ensure that illegals don't come in. They don't even have time to use it. They're processing and taking care of illegal aliens that are costing, just the children alone cost us $800 a day.
Oh, my gosh. It's just, it's staggering, staggering. I want to ask you a couple of other questions about some former top White House officials. Gary Cohn is lashing out at some of his former colleagues at the White House, talking about how it's living in chaos. He's clearly upset about the China tariffs that have been put in place, even though they clearly have had a positive effect on getting China to the table and obviously gotten China to, if nothing else, gotten China's attention. But he said tariffs don't work. If anything, they hurt the economy. We have the best economy in the G7. How has it really hurt our economy?
Well, I'll tell you about a conversation I had with Gary, I think, the day he resigned. And he pretty much said, he's like, look, I don't agree with the president on the tariffs and his trade policy, and so I can't keep working for him. And, you know, I think one thing, you know, and you've worked in an administration beforehand, that our job here is to serve as advisors. We provide counsel. We give him give the president the best information that we have. And what I like about this president is that he does put a Peter Navarro in the room at the same time he puts a Gary Cohn in the room and a Secretary Mnuchin. They come from two different trade policy philosophies, but he's able to hear the debate and discussion. And then the president is the ultimate decider. There is no question the president and his decision to be tough on China, where China for
what's
decades,
the alternative? What's Gary Cohn's? I mean, look, what is Gary Cohn's alternative? And you're being very diplomatic, and I understand why. But Goldman Sachs and other investment firms like it have made billions of dollars betting on China. They have billions of dollars. I get it. They want to make a lot of money. But guess what? The president's supposed to be representing the interests of America. So if America can right the ship here on trade and make these practices fairer and make China accountable for cheating and dumping and all this stuff that they do, then that's going to help America. So for Gary, I mean, I think it's great that Gary Cohn's attacking the president on tariffs. That tells me Trump is exactly where he needs to be. Exactly. Because otherwise the Democrats are going to run to the right of Trump on trade. I can tell you that right now.
Right. And the president had a meeting yesterday with a bunch of Republican senators. They talked about USMCA. They talked about China.
Better pass that, too.
Yeah. And the Republicans get nervous about where the president is on China. But here's the deal. Because he's put so much pressure on China, we're seeing a lot more of the Chinese buying our agricultural products, which they weren't doing so beforehand. We're putting them on alert about intellectual property and the fact that they need to stop stealing our technology, stealing our innovation, stealing our intellectual property. And he's not going to move on a trade deal until we know it's the right trade deal and that it benefits the American workers. And look, it's tough because he did have to sell that tariff message that made a lot of these senators and constituencies nervous. But it was the right approach because for too long, and the president says this all the time, he says that the Chinese said, oh, we could take advantage of the Americans because it's all about status quo. They did not want to ruffle any feathers. And this president is saying, no more. We get a better deal. We need to do more trade with China, but at the same time, we're going to keep you accountable and work on figuring out how you stop stealing our intellectual property. And I think that's a very strong message, and they respect the president for that.
Yeah, I keep saying, tell me what your alternative is. Because we see China's effect on the South China Seas now. Vietnam, which obviously is a big trading partner with China, Vietnam actually has historical ownership and entitled to various islands in the South China Sea. It's irrefutable. You know what they do? They just put people. They just put a big guy in the Chinese Communist Party, historian on that particular issue, and in the Vietnamese Communist Party, excuse me. They just took him out of party leadership because he dared to criticize the Chinese. It's almost like we're edging into that territory in Hollywood and journalism where people are afraid to take on China because the power that we've given them over us, over the United States. Unbelievable.
No, and you're right. And you talk about artificial intelligence and 5G.
They're ahead of us.
And you go into that whole area and you're saying, who is going to be the dominance? Is it going to be America or is it going to be
one or the other?
And let me tell you, I'll put my bet on Donald Trump that he's going to make sure America stays dominant in the role of technology and technological development here in the United States.
What was the reaction inside the White House when those stories came out about how former Vice President Cheney confronted Pence over Trump's foreign policy, saying the administration looks more like Obama than Reagan? What was that all about?
You know, I have to say, and you know, I worked under the Bush administration and have worked with the
I
vice president
you.
As well.
Sorry.
You know, I first of all, of course, and you know the VP, Vice President Pence well, he's just so polite and respectful that he definitely wanted to make sure that it would be a vigorous debate. But there is no question that under George W. Bush, we ended up in endless wars. We started a war where it really created a lot of chaos in the Middle East. And this president has a very different approach than George W. Bush. So I just have to ask if Vice President Cheney was just trying to make up for feeling guilty because of the wars that we ended up in, while President Trump has been practical in saying, we've spent trillions and trillions of dollars on these endless wars. I'm wanting to change direction on this. And at the same time, being tough on Iran, being pro-Israel, and ensuring that we're not taken for granted and abused by our NATO allies and others, where they're saying, look, you got to pay your fair share. So I think we've made more progress, have been more innovative in the area of foreign policy. We have gone where no other administration's gone before in terms of figuring out, okay, how can we accomplish denuclearization in North Korea? And this president is going to think strategically and differently than former administrations.
Yeah, well, I just kept thinking, well, I guess that Christian Bale portrayal really must have really the movie Vice really must have gotten
to
old
movie.
Cheney.
Yeah, how was the movie?
There were moments that it was just funny, but it was over the top. But I'm just like, and the great thing is that the media, they can't stand Cheney. They couldn't stand Bush. But now if Cheney or Bush are criticizing Trump, then they're the best friends of the American media. It's so transparent. It's almost laughable. I just laugh at it. And I'm like, oh, okay, now Cheney's a man of the moment on the Washington Post writing this glowing piece. Well, good for him for standing up to
Vice. I don't think they remember that they used to call Cheney Darth Vader. So it's I don't know where the change came. I don't think they agree with Vice President Cheney's approach to foreign policy.
No. Well, we could also make the argument, and I've made it many times, including in books, that there's a good part of the reason Barack Obama was elected in 2008 is not just the economy, but people had enough of these wars. And John McCain basically just ran on an extension of Bush's foreign policy, and people had want no part of that. So that's really why Obama was able to, you know, beat out Hillary Clinton back in 2008. I just want to play one thing, Mercedes, before we let you go. I know you have to go. But the president was asked about Beto O'Rourke, and he said this today.
Well, I think he's got a lot of hand movement. I've never seen so much hand movement. I said, is he crazy or is that just the way he acts? So I've never seen hand movement. I watched him a little while this morning doing, I assume it was some kind of a news conference. And I've actually never seen anything quite like it. Study it. I'm sure you'll agree.
Okay,
did you call the president before that happened?
I just said that on the podcast. Okay, I just said that on the podcast.
I heard you.
Oh, you heard it. Okay, I'm sorry, Mercedes. No, that cracked me up. Okay, there is a lot of hand motion.
It is a bit of a distraction, I have to be quite honest.
Mercedes,
we gotta focus on this national emergency.
I know.
Get this going.
No. That's the most important thing, and we look forward to the president not buckling on this issue or any of the issues where he stood firm for the American people. Got to keep doing it, and including on China, including on this. And we support him 100% on those issues. Mercedes Schlapp, thank you so much for joining us. It's always great to talk to you. Let's go to Ken in Colorado. Ken, go ahead. Welcome to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Hey, Laura. How are you?
I'm great.
Hey, listen, as far as Beto O'Rourke goes, this guy couldn't even win his own state with tens of millions of dollars behind him. So his entry into the 2020 presidential campaign with folks like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and everyone's favorite American Indian, Elizabeth Warren, it really only solidifies the Democratic Party as the biggest clown show in America. My feeling is that as long as Americans actually love America, we'll keep their focus on what's important, and that's having a president who will put America first in every important decision that he makes. And President Trump should be serving a second term. And frankly, if he loses this election and we allow another Democrat into the White House, then we deserve exactly what we're going to get, which is going to be open borders, higher taxes, a gutted military, fewer jobs, continuous attacks on our Second Amendment, and a huge push towards socialism, which, by the way, has worked so well in other countries, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Look at what's happening in the rest of the G7 right now. Even Germany is seeing a slowdown, which had obviously a very strong economy. They're all slowing down. And Britain tries to save itself and save its sovereignty. And look at what the elites do in Britain. They're like, no, you can't do Brexit. Trying to delay that. Britain doesn't want to have decisions made for it in Brussels. They want to make their own decisions about their own immigration and their own internal policies. And the EU prevented them from doing that. People rose up and the middle class said, we're not doing this anymore. But the elites still say no. It's unbelievable. The elites, they are the elites for a reason. They don't give up. They just come back for another bite at the apple. That's why Gary Cohn's trashing Trump now. How dare he, Mr. Goldman Sachs? Of course he wants China to keep business going the way it's going, which is corruptly. Of course he wants to do that. It's utter corruption, communist style in China. And Goldman and all these companies made big bucks off of it. They want all the IPOs with China. They want all the partnerships with China. They paved the way for American investment in China. But guess what? The reciprocal deal is never done. I mean, China comes here and just buys our companies, brings in, and they want to just bring in their own workforces. They do that in the islands of Bahamas. They're doing it in South America and even in Central America. China's gaining footholds in key parts of the world. Zambia, Zimbabwe, signage on the roads in Chinese. It's staggering. But that's because they have trillions and trillions of dollars in growth, courtesy of wild trade deficits and corrupt trade policies. All right, you're listening to The Laura Ingraham Show. And remember, the podcast is here because we have great products and great companies that advertise with us. And if you want great skincare, well, that means you have to hook up with my friends at GenuCell. GenuCell is awesome for many reasons. The GenuCell under eye treatment for bags and puffiness is the flagship product. You'll love it once you try it. I took it with me when I was in New York this week, and it was awesome. So morning and night, make yourself look fresher. By the time you wake up, your skin will look tighter. Your skin will look, it has that clean, healed, it's almost like a healing on your skin. And also the under eye bags and puffiness is good to get now because the jawline treatment, which is awesome, you know, the jawline treatment is their newest product, and people are already sending in testimonials because they have natural actives, pure antioxidant base, no parabens, no chemical scents, and it tightens that skin along your jawline and your chin. So all you need to do is text EYES1 to 77453 or go to GenuCell.com. That's GenuCell.com. Chamonix 100% money-back guarantee, so you only have the bags, wrinkles, and some of that extra saggage around your chin to lose. Order now while 3-day shipping is still free. Again, text EYES1 to 77453 or go to GenuCell.com.
Are you optimistic that this can be sorted?
Am I optimistic in general? I think so. We've got a new generation of young people also who are pretty active. They're pretty activist about things like their privacy, whereas to a certain extent they weren't before. So yes, I think we've got both the ability and the motivation to try to do the right thing on both governments and companies, so long as the individuals, if necessary, protesting in the streets, hold them to account.
Tim Berners-Lee is the man who really is responsible for the development of the World Wide Web. And he was raising kind of a red flag, a warning flag to everyone, especially people and young people across the globe. And we're focusing on America, of course, here on the Laura Ingraham podcast. But about your data, about your privacy, it's almost become cliche to say, well, protect your privacy, protect your data. And a lot of young people roll their eyes because they think, well, I'm fine. You know, there's no real privacy anyway. So just don't sweat it. Just live and let live. Well, that's not really the way to go. We learned that Facebook and its deals to share data with other companies is now under investigation by a federal grand jury looking at various partnerships that gave tech companies broad access to Facebook users' information. So this grand jury in New York has subpoenaed records from at least two prominent makers of smartphones and other devices, according to two people who were familiar with the document requests and insisted on anonymity to discuss confidential legal matters. Both companies had entered into partnerships with Facebook, gaining broad access to the personal information of hundreds of millions of its users. So Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Sony, they all cut these basically these sharing deals with Facebook, which is the dominant social media platform still, even though it's had its problems. So the agreements that were you saw reported on in various news outlets let the companies see your friends, your contact information, and other data, sometimes without consent. Facebook has now phased out most of those partnerships over the past 2 years, but problems, big problems, still remain. Joining us now, I'm really happy he's with us, giving us some common sense ways that we can protect our data. Tom Kelly is the president and CEO of ID Experts. It's a leading provider of ID protection and data breach services for both individuals and companies across the country. He joins us now. Hey, Tom, great to talk to you. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Laura.
What is happening here? Is privacy, is it possible? I'm going to ask it this way. Is it possible to safeguard your personal information if you are, like most Americans, on the internet every day?
You can provide, you can use some good common sense on what you share and how you share it. But the fact is, all the material you put on these social platforms are available to be mined. Mined in terms of how Facebook, and we'll use Facebook as an example, I heard you talking, as an example, they mine everything you and I do when we go on Facebook in an effort to push advertising and push other kinds of, their business model is to drive ads. Their business model is you and I. We're the product. That's the product, us. And so when you go on Facebook or any social platform, you need to be conscious of what it is you're sharing and that it's ultimately going to be available for other people to utilize one way or the other. And so once you put it out there, it's out there. And the fact is, I think we talked at another time, if you look at what information is available for you and I, we have a lot of private information floating around the dark web that's available already. I'm sure your Social Security is out there. Mine is probably out there. There's addresses. There's emails. They might have passwords. All kinds of information is out there. So fundamentally, there's a great opportunity for the nefarious actors to assemble profiles of us to use fraudulently one way or the other, to either create false identities or all kinds of things.
So what is the, can you explain, I know this is probably a really moronic question, but what is the dark web and how do you gain access to it?
Well, you gain access through particular kinds of browsers. You really don't want to be browsing around there because the dark web, the best way to think about it, and this is in not completely technically accurate, but it's kind of like eBay for criminals. You can go on the web. You can go in there and there's different browsers that allow you to have access and different kinds of credentials that you can create to get in and browse and gather data on there. But the dark web is a place where The primary currency used is going to be cryptocurrencies because of the anonymous features associated with them, the ability to buy and sell information, everything from, you know, you name it, anything that's illegal. It's a great place to be floating around, from terrorism all the way down to good old-fashioned neighborhood crime in terms of stealing identities.
Now,
it's not what you search when you search your Google page or use any other search engine.
Oh. So is it like www.somethingelse.com?
Yes. Well, it'd be a browser that brings you right into that.
Oh.
A specific browser you would download, and quite frankly, I don't have that browser downloaded, because the minute you download it, you become a target. I do not want to be associated. I do not want to be associated
with
floating around
the
dark web.
No,
because of course law enforcement knows if you're downloading that browser and you're going in there, that you're probably not doing something that's very good.
So then, what do you do? What does the average person do about personal information that, as you say, is floating around the dark web now? Is there any way to get it back, or is there any way to turn it around, or what do we tell our listeners across the country and, frankly, across the world about this?
First of all, this is what if I would tell you or any members of my family or anything like that. First of all, have good security hygiene. And what's that mean? Well, it starts with your passwords. All the passwords you use to protect your accounts, make sure that you change them on a regular basis. Make sure that they're not simple and easy to identify, the name of your dog, your cat, your wife's name. You know, literally, I say this, people chuckle, but you'd be amazed at the kinds of passwords that people utilize. Make sure it's in a place that you can get your hands on it, but other people can't get your hands on it. And make sure you change them on a regular basis. That's really the first thing. Secondly, be careful where you conduct business. Don't conduct your financial and other kinds of important business on public non-secured networks, sitting in your local coffee shop, for example. That information that floats between your computer through that network can be grabbed. Okay, it can be grabbed. We don't have to get into that, but it can be grabbed and can be compromised. And lastly, be really careful about what it is you connect in your home, and understand that every time you connect these boxes, these devices that we've loved, the personal assistants, the electronic doorbell, all these smart features in a house, that everything that's in your network there becomes another access point. It's another access point, so you have to think in terms of your security there. And don't advertise everything you do in your life on Facebook. You know, you and I, at one time, we probably learned growing up, if you went on vacation, you asked your neighbor to keep an eye on your house, you stopped the delivery of the paper, all the little kind of things, you let somebody know, things didn't pile up. Now we post pictures of ourselves saying, hey, we're off in the Bahamas, we're here, we're there, you know, nobody's at home. These things, we got to start using some common sense here.
What about the different types of browsers that people can use? Like, I know there are a bunch of conservative friends that are moving away from Google, and there are a couple of other browsers that are far less popular that you can use. Does that help protect your information? Or at least Google doesn't have it, obviously.
I'm not going to promote one browser, but there are browsers out there, and it would be, you know, I think it's a good idea for people to look at the various kinds of search engines that are available that they can utilize in browsers. When you go into a website, if you've got that little lock that looks like a padlock on the top of your screen, it's not a guarantee, but it's a reminder that site's secure, and that the information, as long as you're in a secure environment between you and them, is moving and it is securely, it's encrypted. These are all important, and you know, there's steps. We should just start thinking about this stuff, and taking common sense actions. I don't think we live in paranoia, but we also recognize that there is some level of risk when we go in to the web, so make sure you use it intelligently.
A friend of mine said to me, if you had to say 1 year, point out 1 year that you'd like to kind of return to, just not because of anything other than the way kind of life was? And that's a real fuddy-duddy question, but it's kind of a fun one. If you could go back to 1 year, and I'd go back to 1985. I'd go back to 1985 because it was a rah-rah years of Reagan. The Soviet Union was on the verge of collapse. We didn't have the social media. We had the internet was just coming to the fore. We didn't have this, you know, cell phones weren't dominating our lives. I got to say, I think this, you know, the World Wide Web creator, Tim Berners-Lee's points are really well taken. That, you know, the first 15 years or so wasn't bad for the internet, but now it's become a place for nastiness, criminality, porn, debasement, time wasted, marriages destroyed. I know that sounds really grim and probably simplistic, but I think life was a lot simpler.
I think you're absolutely right.
Before that,
think of the things that kids do when you're young, and you did them. Anybody who said they grew up and they didn't have events growing up, and even to adulthood and others, you say, "Boy, that was stupid." You know, I wish I didn't. Now we take these stupid events and we put them on the web. And we put them out there on various social media to be sitting there forever. And, you know, there's almost an unforgiving, almost a lack of mercy in the use of the web that doesn't afford you some of the abilities to say, hey, that was just a dumb, stupid thing.
Oh,
and
my God.
By golly, I learned, but I'm not going to do it again. Now it comes back to haunt you.
No,
and right. Marriages, yeah. Everything's been destroyed under that.
And by the way, Dr. Drew Pinsky was on the Ingram Angle with me, and he said, Laura, I think in 15 years from now, we're going to view these. And he held up the phone. We're going to view these like we viewed cigarettes for kids. That it was not good. Not good for the kids, not good for concentration, focus, retaining information, knowing where you are and how to get there without Waze or one of the, you know, Google Maps, your brain not developing. It's demanding dopamine, more dopamine from Instagram or pose this way or jealousy, all the things that it encourages. Again, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So good intentions of the internet, some good stuff. But man, I gotta say, I say this at least once a week. I'm so glad I grew up without the internet. I'm so glad I grew up without screens.
I wrote an op-ed recently that I was talking about the Facebook, and it was an op-ed that I put out.
I got off Facebook.
After the disclosures that Facebook was actually getting information from certain apps from people who weren't even Facebook users on women's health, I just found it egregious that they would actually have gone into that area, and I look at that and I said, maybe it's time to start treating Facebook, and I used Facebook specifically, like you did cigarettes. There maybe is a big banner ad that says, once you log into Facebook, are you sure you want to do this? Do you understand what it is you're going to be sharing, what they're going to be able to do with your information? I mean, it's a, you know, of course we're not going to do that probably, but, you know, there comes a point in time where we have to recognize that while there's value to these social apps and you can see value in them in terms of the convenience and others, but boy, they sure bring baggage with them as well.
Wow. We really appreciate your words of wisdom on Tom Kelly, CEO of ID Experts. Tom, thank you so much. And I want everybody to celebrate with me my friend Adam Carolla. His show just hit its 10-year anniversary. It's great. And he's kicking it off in style because Adam is joining forces this week with Jimmy Kimmel and Jay Leno on CarCast. So Jimmy Kimmel is going to be on the Adam Carolla Show. Jay is going to be on CarCast. Congrats to Adam. Download the Adam Carolla Show and CarCast every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Ilhan Omar is a refugee from Somalia. She comes from a different culture. She has things to learn. And I want to tell you that Ilhan Omar, Congresswoman, is under tremendous attack, death threats. I think maybe she needs some security. And why? Because I think in part the Republicans and the media have blown this up to be much more than it is.
blown this up to be much more than it is. That's Congresswoman leftist Jan Schakowsky, really indicating that everybody is just gone way overboard with Ilhan Omar's comments about Israel and hinting that there's this divided allegiance, and her comments even before that about, you know, it's the bowel about the Benjamin's baby, meaning money, all this, you know, all this, the worst stereotypes of Jewish people worldwide. This is, we've seen a rise in anti-Semitism in Europe, in Britain, and even here in the United States. This video that I tweeted out a few days back that the Yeshiva World News first alerted me to. The title is Hate in Crown Heights in New York. Black man deliberately kicks carriage pushed by Jewish woman, carriage with her child in it. And it was actually caught on videotape, and they're trying to find out who did it. And it's an Orthodox Jewish woman, and obvious by her dress, apparently. And it says the neighborhood where Orthodox Jews and Muslims work and live in close proximity. Now, this is just one person and one incident. But for me, it's one incident too many. And joining us now, and I'm delighted she's with us, Evelyn Marcus is the director of Never Again Is Now. It's a documentary investigating the troubling global rise of anti-Semitism and her story, her family's story of fleeing Europe all the way back 13 years ago because of the rise in anti-Semitism, and what she's seeing today in the United States that could lead to the same types of disturbing images and trends we're seeing in Europe. And Brussels, you know, is, in my view, Brussels is just lost. It's lost. Evelyn joins us now. Evelyn, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you, Laura, for having me on your show.
Absolutely. Where are we now? The United States has always been considered a place safe for Jewish people, a refuge of sorts for Israelis who want to come here, vacation here, move here, and Jewish people, period, succeeded, thrived, amazing success stories. But now we see a disturbing rise in anti-Jewish sentiment that is being excused by Democrat leadership.
Correct. I can't believe what I'm seeing here. I see the first signs of what I saw happening in Europe in my lifetime. I was born and raised in Holland, in Amsterdam, after the World War II. And I grew up virtually without any anti-Semitism in Holland. But that changed. It started to change in the 70s when Holland was going from pro-Israel. Academia was flipping to anti-Israel and pro-Palestinian. And that became more and more not only criticism of Israel, but also delegitimization of Israel and anti-Semitic. And then in 2000, we saw a rise in attacks on Jews in the streets, like you see now in Brooklyn. The violent attacks were mainly coming from the Muslim population. So we saw in Europe, first academia flipping from pro-Israel to anti-Israel and pro-Palestinian. Then, from there, the media and the elite becoming anti-Israel.
Is it because, Evelyn, I'm sorry to interrupt here, but is it because the Israel and the United States became closer, ever closer through the years? And so if you're opposed to the great Satan of America, or America's too heavy-handed in foreign policy or trade policy, what have you, then it's easier to be anti-Israel or vice versa. Is the connection with America part of it?
It's part of it, because in this era, it's the hard left that usually drives the vehement anti-Israel activism.
But now it's mainstreamed, Evelyn. It's mainstreamed. I'm trying to figure out why it got mainstreamed. And you think it's over the last 30 years or so, it became really mainstreamed, because I think the plight of the Palestinian people, the Palestinian Muslims, was seen connected to the plight of other oppressed people,
yes.
American blacks, women,
yes.
Gays. So they've wrapped this all up into one big bag of oppression. And the Palestinians are part of that that movement, which is kind of a Marxist liberation movement, correct? That's how I see it. Yeah, and that's how I see this.
That's how I see it as well. And in other words, as soon as Jews stop to be victims, they are the obscure, powerful group that steers society obscurely. So we saw the change in Europe after the Six-Day War. So that was a war that Israel won miraculously. And from that moment on, the hard left didn't see Israel anymore as the victim, but as then they became the oppressor.
By the way, there's a news that just came out today. Fox is reporting it, that California's Pitzer College, this is a private liberal arts college in Claremont, California, it ran a range of programs, foreign study programs, including one which is very popular at an Israeli university. Well, the college is going to vote on ending the Israel study program with the support of Congresswoman Tlaib.
Yeah.
Another one of the left-wing newbie it girl congresswomen.
Yeah. That's a BDS policy, right? A policy to boycott Israel. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that Israel's singled out, and that is one of the criteria for being anti-Semitic, is to single out Jews for your criticism or to single out the Jewish state. And in my view, that's a form of it.
Right now, I think a lot of Americans are trying to understand where the Democrat Party is going. And Nancy Pelosi's fairly successfully, I think, has quelled the uprising for now. And you have now the presidential race heating up. How do you expect this to develop going into 2020 before we let you go? The issue of Israel, I think AOC and Tlaib and Ayanna Pressley, again, these radical new congresswomen, they believe they've opened the door to a, quote, frank and honest conversation about U.S. policy toward Israel. And they think that is going to have a profound impact on the way we view the state of Israel and their own internal approach to the Palestinian people.
It's hard to predict which way it will go. I think the congresswomen you refer to resonate well with a younger population, college population, that gets this kind of anti-Israel information all the time. If I look at Europe, I see the Labour Party in England, in the UK, where the leader of that party, Jeremy Corbyn, sympathizes with Hamas, Hezbollah, calls them freedom fighters. I see in the Netherlands, where I'm from, the Green Party on the left adopted the BDS campaign as an official program for them. So I hope that that's not going to happen with the Democratic Party in America. It depends on how many moderates are left.
Well, it depends on what American Jews say, too, right? I mean, American Jews, and we're almost out of time, but American Jews have become very self-loathing in the words of, I think it was Charles Krauthammer, that with their self-loathing tendency. Again, it's this idea of what Shelby Steele calls the white guilt.
Yeah,
like we're guilty. The whites are guilty for all these sins, past sins, and so we have to atone for those sins. And now we'll atone by making concessions to the Palestinians that are unwarranted or not balanced with concessions that they give. And so, again, it's all wrapped up in this progressive self-flagellation about past wrongs. So I think that's where we are. And Evelyn, we really appreciate your joining us. The director of Never Again Is Now. If you have a chance to watch it online and watch parts of it online, please do. We'll link that up on lauraingram.com and our Facebook page so you can learn more about what Evelyn's her life story and what it tells us about America now and what could be happening here in this country. We have to stay ahead of these threats, whether they're national security threats or threats of ideologies that would rob us of our freedom. All right. We have a lot more to get to on the Laura Ingram podcast, including the speaking of rise of anti-Semitism, there's a rise of anti-Catholic sentiment. It's anti-Christian sentiment. Christophobia has been around for a long time. It's the last group you can really ridicule are the Christians, and especially with all the stuff that Catholic Church is going through, these abuse scandals, corruption. The urge is to throw the whole thing out, just cast everyone as an evil villain. And so then on Saturday Night Live, they had this skit. This is Pete Davidson. He got himself in some trouble with his comments earlier this year about Congressman Dan Crenshaw has the patch on his eye because he's a war hero. But now I think he feels safe to make these kinds of references.
Have you guys seen the R. Kelly documentary?
Yeah, Pete, I did.
Okay, now before I continue, like, this guy is a monster, and he should go to jail forever. But if you support the Catholic Church, isn't that like the same thing as being an R. Kelly fan? No, I don't really see the difference. Only like one's music is significantly better. The other day, my mom was like, I'm going to Mass. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go listen to the Ignition remix.
Oh, my God. I tweeted back, try that against the Muslims, Pete. Let's see how brave you are. Let's start making Muhammad jokes. And then we'll think you're like an equal opportunity critic. Joining us now, my dear friend, Father Jerry Murray, pastor at the Holy Family Church in New York. We also have St. Patrick's Day coming up. Misconceptions about what St. Patty's Day is. Everyone thinks just about drinking. Breaking your fast if you gave up something for Lent. What this rise in the anti-Christian, especially anti-Catholic rhetoric is all about, and what we as people who try to be good Christians, I mean, we fail, but we try. What can we do about this? He joins us now. Hi, Father Murray. How are you?
Hey, Laura. Great to be with you.
Absolutely. We love watching you on Raymond's show, by the way. You're fantastic. Love it.
Thanks.
On EWTN. We just love watching your analysis, listening to you. Your comments about this SNL skit, I mean, Davidson didn't write this. One of the writers did. He's just the mouthpiece for it. But I know Bill Donahue from the Catholic League was just firing off about this. But what are your thoughts? Is it something we should just shrug off or no?
No, we got to fight this because this is bigotry that is not just occasional. It's constant. Taking advantage of the clerical sex abuse scandal to tear down the whole religion, to imply that all priests are predators like R. Kelly, that's a slander, that's bigotry, it's something that's completely unacceptable.
Well, it's acceptable, but what do we do? Use the power of the purse? I mean, the left launches boycotts and manages to do financial damage to companies and individuals. Is that what conservatives should do? Should conservatives have a group like Media Matters that really goes to town on these people and organizes protests and so forth? I mean, conservatives just don't have the time to protest. They're working and taking care of their families, but the left is like the squeaky wheel gets the grease, so that's why they're out there.
Yeah, but you and I and your listeners know, Laura, a lot of the indignation on the left is trumped up. It's designed to silence critics. It's designed to turn everything into kind of a narrative that says the left is the virtuous group and anybody who doesn't agree with us has to be shut down. My reaction to when people do these kind of things is, leaders in the Catholic community should come out and condemn it. I was very glad the Diocese of Brooklyn condemned it immediately. Bill Donahue is a real hero on this. But it doesn't hurt if individual people want to write to companies to say, you know, why are you paying the bills for a show that is promoting bigotry? Nothing wrong with that, but we have a more principled way to defend this, which is to say, look, if you're an American and you subscribe to the Constitution of the United States, religious hatred being stirred up is against what it means to be a loyal and good citizen. And respect for religion is part of human decency. So, whatever people want to do is great, but I don't want to get into the indignity machine that the left, trumps up, because they use that to silence people that should be speaking.
George Will writes a piece today, or late yesterday, has the Catholic Church committed the worst crime in U.S. history, focused on the sexual abuse scandal? And I know I know so many great, good, and holy priests, and I feel I feel heartbroken for victims and everything that they live through and go through and how their lives were, in many cases, just irreparably harmed. their innocence robbed. And I also think of those who've devoted their life to the church and service of others and who are lumped in with this because it's so unfair to them. Yet they have to answer these questions morning, noon, and night. And so I kind of hate bringing this up, but this is the story of the day. Is, you know, and prominent people, prominent Catholics are saying, if this is the Catholic Church, I can't be part of this. And what are your thoughts, especially after the Cardinal Pell conviction in Australia, the Poland report about the 340 or so priests since 1990 are involved in some type of abuse? What next?
Yeah, no, I bet George Will is onto something there. You know, I've been a Catholic priest almost 35 years. I had no idea when I entered the seminary that the priesthood had so many sexual perverts who were taking advantage of young people and adults. And I had no idea that the hierarchy as a group had a general modus operandi of covering up and protecting these monsters in the name of, you know, the good of the church, but it usually meant they didn't want to be implicated as having let this stuff go on. So for me, the best thing that can be applied here is continued public pressure. And the legal system is probably the most coercive thing we have in America. That should be used to, you know, arrive at the truth here. You know, the McCarrick situation, for instance, that we had a cardinal very influential in the church, and it was known for years that he was active homosexual, going after seminarians. Then it was real going after young boys. And what happened? Not until some brave young man, late many years later, came forward to a reconciliation committee in New York, did this stuff become public. And, you know, that took courage on that victim's part. Mm-hmm. And then the media, you know, by bringing this to the attention, a second one came out. This is one time I'll praise the New York Times. They interviewed a man named James Grine, and he revealed that McCarrick had abused him when he was 11 years old. Oh. Turns out Grine was the first kid that was ever baptized by McCarrick because he was son of a friend of McCarrick. I mean, this McCarrick is a truly evil man in his actions. And, you know, you talked about the Polish situation. We've got scandals all over the globe. Right now, the Catholic Church is reeling, and the response is not adequate. Our bishops need to do much more. The Pope needs to do more. And as a priest who is horrified by what's going on, you know, I think I speak for a lot of priests. If the bishops don't take this matter in hand quickly, the credibility of the church is really going to go down the drain. We're going to lose a lot of people who shouldn't leave the church because we have bad leaders.
Well, it looks like the numbers are down in church. Church attendance is down and has been for some years. But this idea that, well, Francis, it was going to be the Francis effect, and we're going to have all these new parishioners because he's from South America and Italy, and he's going to bring this huge tidal wave of parishioners in. How has that panned out?
Not really. In fact, you know, Pope Francis himself is implicated in cover-ups. He, you know, Archbishop Vigano, who was the nuncio, meaning the papal ambassador in America, he told the Pope in 2013 that McCarrick had been put under sanctions for his sexual abuse of seminarians by Pope Benedict, and Francis didn't care. He used McCarrick as an envoy to Red China and had him as an advisor and all the rest. Now it's revealed that there was a bishop in Argentina named Sanqueta.
Friends of his.
Yeah, who was a personal friend of the Pope, appointed by the Pope to become bishop back in 2013. He was going after seminarians. He had gay porn on his phone. He horribly immoral man, and the Pope took him to Rome and gave him a job in the Vatican. And only when it hit the newspapers in December of 2018, then he was asked to step aside. But the Pope has answered no questions about Sanqueta. This is not good.
No. And I think, again, if the legal system works its way, the Catholic Church as we know it could be, you know, the institution, the physical structure of the church could be gradually just sold off, right? I mean, to pay for all these settlements and legal bills, and I've already sold off churches in New Orleans. I was down in New Orleans with Raymond and a good friend of mine who runs St. Stephen's there. He runs a school, too. He said they closed two of our schools in New Orleans. So many kids had nowhere to go, and we're trying to bring as many as we can here, but had to sell off the properties. Yeah, it's very hard to maintain.
You know, you can't maintain an institution if the people don't believe in the leadership, and that's what's happening here. People still believe in God, and we've got to say, look, your faith in God goes through the church because the church is Christ present in the world. So don't forget the church. But it's hard to tell that to people who see, you know, a bishop protecting a molester priest and the victims going on TV crying about what happened to them. I completely sympathize with the victim.
Well, and Cardinal Pell, I want to talk about that for a moment. Again, a lot of you might not know these names, but it's important to bring this up. He was a very prominent conservative cardinal in Australia. He also, according to Raymond, I think you've said this, he also knew a lot about the Vatican's finances. He suddenly, and he's a very manly man, like he's just a very kind of athlete, like he gets convicted on sex abuse. They made a big deal of it in Australia. What do we know about that case? I know a lot of prominent Catholics think the evidence against him was not strong and clear as it was against so many of these other predators.
Well, Laura, I know you're a lawyer. Both my mom and dad are lawyers. One thing my dad always said to me, unless you're in the courtroom, you really don't know what happened.
No.
And so I respect the jury system. If the prosecution is able to convince a jury that this man was guilty, that means they had a strong case. Now, whether the jury was manipulated, whether the defense was weak, you know, that the appeal process that I'm read about in Australia, which will happen in June, will give his defense counsel final opportunity to make the case that so many of the cardinal's friends are making the media, which is that it was impossible that this alleged crime happened. But, you know,
we'll see.
One thing that troubled me, the cardinal never took the stand in his own defense.
Yeah, why not? That was troubling.
I'm a priest. If my whole future was going to be ruined, my past destroyed by either a crazy or malicious fraudster trying to ruin my life, I'm getting in the stand whether my lawyer tells me to sit down or not.
That's a great point. And again, I've just been reading dribs and drabs. That's why I asked you about it, because I didn't even know he didn't testify in his own behalf. That was stupid.
He did not.
That was not good. And finally, on a lighthearted moment here, St. Paddy's Day, P-A-D-D, right? Not P-A-T-T,
That's right.
Which everyone say. But tell us a little bit about St. Patrick's Day, because everybody takes it as a day to drink green beer and green cupcakes and bagels and so forth. But what is it really all about?
Sure. No, St. Patrick's Day is about the Apostle of Ireland. St. Patrick was the bishop who basically converted the Irish people away from paganism. And he did throw through preaching, his miracles, his austerity of life. And when the United States was founded, many Irish came and they brought their love of St. Patrick. So in New York, the New York Archdiocese, when it was founded, designated St. Patrick as the patron saint. And he is honored by a parade here in New York, and it's essentially a religious procession. Now, it's degenerated over time into, you know, this kind of carousing and drinking festival, debauchery and all the rest, which is a complete negation of who St. Patrick was. But, you know, I'm Irish-American. I know from living Irish-Americans all my life, we identify Irish and Catholic together. The two words go together so naturally. So the parade does identify Irish heritage, but it's Christian Irish heritage. We're not celebrating paganism in Ireland. We're not celebrating any kind of ancient religion. That's all been wiped away, thank God, by St. Patrick and the later apostles in Ireland, the bishops and priests. So, yeah, it's in New York, the St. Patrick's Day parade has its own life now, which I regret because it's not very much a religious procession anymore. But when I was a kid, this was basically, this was honoring a saint, and that's what it should still be.
Well, we hope you have a wonderful and meaningful rest of your Lent. If we don't talk to you, Father Murray, it is great to hear your perspective on all these issues, extremely important for the future of the Catholic Church and our spiritual lives as Catholics. And we just appreciate you so much. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Laura. God bless you.
All right. And thanks to all of our sponsors supporting this show, this podcast, day after day. Genucel, you order right now and you'll receive Genucel jawline treatment absolutely free just for ordering the classic Genucel plant stem cell therapy. Text EYES1 to 77453 or go to genucel.com. All right. America, now and forever. We'll see you next podcast. The Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Order in the court. The Dan Abrams Podcast is here on Podcast One.
Ah, well, what does it mean then?
Join the renowned lawyer and SiriusXM host as he analyzes the biggest news stories from a legal perspective with a panel of experts, one-on-one interviews with top newsmakers, and listener phone calls.
Again, advanced knowledge in and of itself probably wouldn't be enough. Right. But if he was involved in the coordination of that, I would think that that could be relevant.
Download the Dan Abrams Podcast every week on Podcast One. March Madness is upon us, and it's time to place your bets.
All right, let's get to it.
Join RJ Bell on RJ Bell's Dream Preview as he helps you fill out your bracket with his expert betting advice.
A smaller conference action Friday night. VCU playing a team that should be able to make it to the NCAA tournament.
Get the winning advantage and dominate the brackets by downloading RJ Bell's Dream Preview every week on Podcast One.